I was thinking about last week, last Sunday, as we were going through this week, and I kind of got an object lesson on Wednesday night. Wednesday night we have our midweek study, and we have gone through the practice of the presence of God, and now we're going through the wisdom of the desert, which all connects in a very interesting way in terms of what a life looks like when it really gets right down to ground zero in terms of just being present to God, kind of like that rain in the background that we were talking about a second ago. But we read through a couple of paragraphs of the text that we're going through by Thomas Merton called The Wisdom of the Desert. And these two paragraphs were packed with more profound and mind-bending truth and insight than you normally get in two paragraphs. And we read through them, and I know that what happens is when you hit something that deep, when you hit something that is that alien coming from another point of view, that it just kind of sails right over the head. And we read through it, and it didn't get any comments, so I stopped, like I typically do in these studies, and said, okay, let's talk about this for a second. And the topic was love. The topic was what love really means. And it was interesting because in the first sentence of the two paragraphs, Thomas Merton gives his definition of love. And we spent 20 minutes talking about the definition of love, you know, because some things are just too big to be able to grasp all at once. Some concepts just come from such a different worldview that even when we hear them, even when we understand the words, even when our heads go up and down and we, you know, nod in mental assent and agreement, it doesn't really penetrate. It doesn't really permeate. And it's not that there's anything wrong with the people in the group because they didn't get it. No, it took me 10 years to start getting some of this stuff. It's just the nature of the beast. It's the nature of how we're wired. It's the nature of how we operate as human beings, that we have a worldview. We have a sense of reality that we believe in, and we think that is real, but it really is the filter through which we look at reality. But that thing is hard to change because we don't see it as a filter. We don't see it as a belief system. We see it as reality itself. It's the ground we walk on and the air we breathe. And so something that comes in and challenges that deeply held belief built up over years or decades in our lives is not going to go away easily. Jesus' notion of kingdom is just like that. You know, even when I understood the words and I understood the concept, it took me years to finally to get it to sink down deep enough that it started to change not only the way I chose and decided, but my very attitudes towards life. It just takes some time. And so last Sunday, we went through the Lord's Prayer from a Hebrew-Aramaic point of view. And we were looking at it in a very different way. And, you know, in 35 or 40 minutes, whatever it was that I was up here droning on, you know, I know that this went kind of right over. The words were understood. I know the words were understood. We all sat in agreement. But it's not going to change anything in our lives. It's not going to change the way we process information or the way we go about our lives until we let it sink in. And so what I wanted to do today was to kind of go back and look at prayer again from a little bit different point of view, but start from this jumping off point of the Lord's Prayer, because it's so big. It's so different. It completely, what's the word? Not contradicts necessarily, but it just comes in from a completely different direction than the normal way that we process information in our modern Western culture. We are so cerebral. We are so mentally based. We think everything is about words and about concepts that we can quantify and write down. And we forget that as soon as you quantify something, write it down and give it a name, you've already changed it. It's not the thing that it originally was. And the only way that it exists in its pure state is in real-time experience. And that's what Jesus was all about. That's what the Jews were all about. The Jews are all about action. We're all about thinking. Such a completely different way of processing information. Even Jewish Hebrew nouns come from their verb forms. You know, a pencil to us is something that's wooden and it's about this long and this skinny and has a point on it. You know what a pencil is to a Jew? It's something that you write with. That's it. They go from the action and then go from there to the concept of the person, place, or thing. They're interested in function. We're interested in form. It's a completely different way of processing things, and it comes out in everything. Faith without works is dead means not that you go around trying to prove your faith by doing good deeds, but that the only way you know you have that thing, that concept called faith, is when it's pouring out of you in some sort of action, some sort of decision-making process, some sort of relationship that tightens and deepens. And prayer is exactly the same thing. What do we think prayer is? We do this exercise all the time. You know, what is prayer? And we all come up with all these different answers. You know, prayer is talking to God. Prayer is listening to God. You know, prayer is interceding on the behalf of others. Prayer is praise of God. Prayer is thanksgiving. Prayer is all these things. And no matter how we understand all those concepts, the thing that ties them all together in our minds is that they're word-based. They're mental. You know, it's talking, it's listening, it's asking for things. It's praising, which we understand as, you know, telling God how great he is. Do you think God really needs that, by the way? Does he need to be constantly reinforced? Is he that insecure? He needs all his minions telling him how great he is. You know what praise really is when you think about it? Praise really is acknowledging God's position, acknowledging who he is, his nature, and thereby understanding our relationship to him. Now, that can involve rehearsing how great he is, but that's not the point. The point is understanding our relationship to God. And think about thanksgiving. You know, is that just saying thank you, thank you, thank you? Really what it is taking a deep sense of security in our dependence to God. Acknowledging that everything that matters, everything that we need in life is a gift we could never give ourselves. And so once again, praise and thanksgiving come hand in hand, because once we really understand who God is and who we are in relation, then we can't help but being grateful, because everything we have comes from God. When we take those notions out of the purely mental, purely cerebral, and bring them into the experiential, things start to change. Now we start to move into a prayer form that makes a heck of a lot more sense. The Jews' prayers, the prayers of the Jews, always had three parts to them: praise, petition, and thanksgiving, which is a pretty good balance. I'd say if you really look at the prayers of us today, they're probably at least 90 to 95% petition. We're always asking for things. Think about the way that I'm going to pray about it. What does that mean? I'm going to pray until I get an answer. I want that answer. I want that clarity. I want an insurance policy. I want a risk-free decision. So God, give me the right answer, so I can circle the little dot on the form here and get the right answer. You know, we're looking for something. I'll pray for you. We're looking for something. And no matter how noble the thing that it is that we're looking for, what is prayer really? What really is the purpose of prayer? You know, probably when it comes right down to it, the best possible answer we can give in words is that it's some sort of communication or communing with God. But until we take it beneath words, we're missing the allness of what prayer is. And so we need to take a deeper look and understand what's really going on in prayer. And if the purpose is only to change things, I remember my mom had a wood carving up over the lintel of one of the doors in her house, and it said, "Prayer changes things." You know, I remember looking at that and thinking about all the times I prayed and it didn't change anything. How do you resolve these things? I think prayer does change things, but not in the way that we expect. But the point is that if we think that that is the purpose of prayer, to change circumstances, to change the things in our lives that we don't like, and God really becomes, you know, the big vending machine in the sky, then we've lost the true purpose of prayer. We've lost the deeper sense of what's going on here. And Jesus is trying to bring us back to that. His disciples ask him, "Teach us to pray," you know. Your cousin John the Baptist, he taught his disciples to pray, "Teach us to pray." And he gives us this prayer, and of course we immediately misunderstand again, and we just start reciting the words that he gave us, instead of looking deeper into what it is Jesus was really trying to give us, a process by which we could live our lives that would take us exactly where we needed to go. And if we look at this again, and you can look in your bulletins if you have one in front of you, we talked through five lines of the Lord's Prayer. So simple. And it follows the Hebrew prayer form. The first is praise, and then we go into the thanksgiving. I'm sorry, we go into the petition, you know, and then thanksgiving at the very end. But if you look at it, and we looked at it from this Aramaic point of view, we found out that certain words had meanings that we don't get anymore, we don't understand anymore. And when we go back into those meanings, we find exactly where Jesus is trying to lead us. Hallowed be your name. Kadosh, to hallow something means to set it aside, to set apart, to clear a space for it so that it really sits on its own and has that hallowed space. Not only that, if we're clearing that space interiorly, then we're allowing space for God to come and show us something that we don't already know. We got to clear the space if we're going to be able to accept something we don't already think we know. You can't fill the full vessel. We have to empty the vessel. We have to clear the space. To hallow means to set something aside, to sanctify. Clear that space. Open up. Hollow out. All these ideas are present there. Even in the very word prayer, Selah itself, is that inclining toward, that leaning into, and clearing the interior space. So this first step is clearing a space in our lives. I'm talking about just letting all the noise subside for a moment. Frank and I are going to go on a retreat in early November out to Tucson in the desert, outside in the sticks someplace. And he found this place online. Sounded a little scary at first. But we're going to go, and it is a completely contemplative and silent retreat center. You know, we're going to go for 3 days. And it's right on the edge of the desert outside of Sonora. We're going to have hermitages, so we're going to... Did I say Sonora? I guess it is the Sonoran Desert, but it's in Tucson, all right, outside of Tucson. And it's just 31 acres out in the desert someplace, and we're going to be in these hermitages, and it's completely silent, you know, just trying to clear a space. Looking forward to that. You know, as I was reading through all the material that they sent us by email, I was thinking, imagine what it would like, though, to actually live there. The people who live there and run that retreat center. We're going for 3 days, you know. Knowing Frank, he's going to be bursting at the seam on the drive home. Has to talk. What if you lived there and maintained that kind of silence on a daily basis, day in and day out? You know, shepherding this parade of people through, keeping them quiet, you know, and doing the things that you do day in and day out. What kind of life would that be? Now, for a lot of us, we'd go absolutely stir-crazy inside of a week. But we would all do well to introduce some more cleared space in our lives, some more silence in our lives, because we can't hear what's going on when everything is always pounding, including that voice in our heads. And so any meditation we can do, any centering prayer we can do, any just devotional time we can do where we have that quiet time and let our thoughts just kind of flow into the background, not think about them, but just be silent. This is what Jesus is talking about. What was he doing when he went up into the hills? In fact, in this scene, when they ask him to teach us to pray, the reason they do is because he went up into the hills to pray. And when he comes back, they must have seen something in him. Maybe a refreshment. Maybe a renewed energy. Maybe some kind of glow about his eyes. I want that. Teach me to do that. Teach me to pray. It wasn't just the words, it was a way of living life. And moving on, your kingdom come, your will be done as in heaven, so on earth. Taking those two words, kingdom and will, Malchuta and Sevyana, two words that mean essentially the same thing. To the Jews, the kingdom, Malchuta, was the principles by which the king reigned, not the territory, not the place, but the principles by which he reigned. And the Sevyana, the will, was the delight and the pleasure and the deepest purpose. What would be the rules, what would be the principles by which God reigns, but his delight, his deepest purpose, his overall desire, which is what? Unity, oneness, connection. It's the same thing said twice. If we then, as in heaven, so on earth, can match our desire, if we can desire and take as much pleasure in unity and connection as God does, wow. Well, that's an answered prayer. To pray in His name, in His Shem, in His essence and character, means simply that, to pray with the same sebyana, the same purpose, the same desire. Matching our desire to God's desire. Taking pleasure in what God takes pleasure in, so that we're no longer following rules. Obedience only takes us so far. It's the training wheels on the bike. If we don't graduate from obedience into actually matching our desire to God's desire, we will never enter kingdom, Jesus says. If you can't exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees who are all about rule following, you can't enter kingdom. It's not about obedience and following rules. It's about taking pleasure in what God's pleasure is. Give us the bread of our need this day. Not for this week or this month or for the next 20 years. This day, immersion in this moment, the realization that the only place we will ever meet God is here and now. Staying focused, as we say here, keep your head where your feet are. Stay focused. How often are your minds wandering away from this day and the need and the bread of this day? All the provision is only for this day. Just like the manna was only for this day. You couldn't store it. It doesn't keep. Neither does your spirituality. If you don't rededicate it every day, if you don't rededicate to your marriage every day, you won't have a marriage. Because you got the certificate doesn't mean it's good for 50 years. It's good for this day if you rededicate this day. It's all about the bread for this day. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Freedom and forgiveness, exactly the same thing, exactly the same word in Aramaic. To be forgiven is to be set free. To be set free is to be forgiven. Any kind of debt, any kind of trespass, any kind of sin unbalances a relationship. To forgive is to be set free by rebalancing the relationship. He borrows some money, unbalanced, not free. Pay it off, balanced, free again, forgiven. It's that simple. That's why sins and debts are the same concept in Aramaic and Hebrew as well. Freedom and forgiveness, debts and sins, it's all right here. Released from the past, released from the things that still bind us and hold us down and dog us, create the programming that causes us to act in predictable ways, stimulus response, no thought in between, repeating our patterns over and over to the destruction of ourselves and the people around us. Release from that, freedom from that, forgiveness from that. It's a process. It's something we need to do. The 12 steps, the middle of the 12 steps, 4 through 10, are all about that process. How do you clean that up? How do you get released from the past? And finally, do not let us enter into temptation. Notice not, lead us not into temptation, as if God would lead us into any kind of temptation. God doesn't tempt anyone. But the idea here again, two statements, exactly the same. Do not let us enter into temptation and deliver us from evil. Same idea. Deliver us from evil. Evil we think of, again, as maliciousness or as unlawfulness. But here in the Hebrew, simply means unripeness. Something that's immature. Something that is not ready, able to perform to its desired and designed specifications, maybe. Deliver us from our own immaturity. Deliver us from the things that we still can't do. In other words, grow us to maturity. Take us to completion. Don't let us be diverted from the purpose that we have set out in all these other steps. This is a process. This is the way through. This is what it's all about. Jesus is trying to take us a quantum leap. He's trying to take us into a whole new way of thinking about prayer. It's not relegated to a certain time. It's not relegated to certain words. It just permeates our entire lives. It's seamless. It moves through every decision we make and every relationship. It's a way of living life. And then he needs to contrast it, because we think of prayer cerebrally. The Jews at this time in Jesus, in their national history, as Jesus comes on the scene, were thinking of prayer as a public show. It was an obedient thing that they needed to do so many days, and the more they did it, the more they were understood as righteous, and if they did it publicly, so much the better. And the scribes and the Pharisees were artists at this, you know, picking the most public places during their set times of prayer during the day. And so Jesus, back in Matthew 6:5, is trying to dispel those notions. When you pray, you're not to pray like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners so that they may be seen by men. And truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you're praying, don't use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. Pray then in this way, and then he gives us the Lord's Prayer. And so this whole idea of praying, what prayer is not, you know, it's not a public show. And if you think that we don't do that, think about corporate prayer. Think about the way we pray when we're praying in public. I always find it difficult to pray in public because there's such a conflict of interest there. It can turn into a speech. It can turn into, you know, the prayer, in this case me, you know, trying to impress, trying to gain approval, trying to be very erudite, trying to say something really profound. And if I fall into that, I realize, who the heck am I praying to anymore? Am I praying to God anymore, or am I just trying to send a message? How many times have you heard people pray in a group setting and they're really sending a message to someone in the group? Have you ever heard this? Someone correcting the prayer of the prayer before them? That's cool. Because you get to put God's stamp on top of your correction. It's just like, yeah, this went up to God. No messing with my opinion. You know, we do this. You know, it's a public show. It's something that has all of this built-in conflict of interest. That's why Jesus says, remove all of that. Take it all away. Go someplace where you are alone. That way, none of that stuff takes place. You can just be real. Man, if you're all alone and you're still trying to make a pretentious show, you really got some issues. Yeah. Talking to your other self, I don't know, one of those split personality things. But it removes all of that. And it's a beautiful thing. And this meaningless repetition, you know, whether it's mantras, whether it's just a long-winded prayer. You know, there's one guy that sometimes I talk to on the phone, and it's nobody in here. I just want you to know that. Every time, can we pray at the end? Okay. Because I know it's going to be about 10 minutes before the prayer winds down. It's just a long prayer. And he's sincere and everything, but do we need that many words? The prayers of the ancient Christians were really, really short. You know, the prayer that they liked most, that was said by the ancient desert fathers and mothers, was the prayer of the publican. Remember Jesus in the court of the temple, and there's a Pharisee praying, and he's up there, and he's given the big highfalutin prayer, thank you that I'm not like all the rest of men, especially this poor slob over here, and, you know, on and on and on, and it's a big erudite prayer, and then here's the publican, the tax collector, you know, just beating his chest and say, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner. I'm not worthy. And so the prayer that was most favored by ancient desert fathers and mothers and ancient Christians was just that short prayer. And it was shortened even further to simply in Greek, Kyrie eleison, Lord, have mercy, Lord, have mercy. Sometimes they would say it hundreds of times a day, you know, and it sounds like a mantra, but the idea was that every time they said it, it brought them back to the moment, back to the bread of this day, cleared away all the stuff and brought them back. And eventually they found that they were no longer saying the prayer was saying them, you know, it was just internalized, it was in their very cells almost. It was just part of who they were. In other words, what they graduated to was from the words came just a seamless awareness throughout their day of God's presence. This process Jesus is talking about, short prayers, meaningful prayers, prayers that reinforce the relationship between God and us. Lord, have mercy. I understand my position with you. I understand my dependence on you. Lord, just keep me in your grace. Keep me in the center of your love. You know, it's very human to pray that way. Even though we're always in the center of God's love, it's human to say that because we don't always feel in the center of God's love. But we don't need all that repetition. We don't all that need all of those words, simple, alone. And then when we do pray corporately, I mean, we have to do that if we're in church and we're in relationship with others. Keep those things in mind. Minimize your conflict of interest. You know, If you're praying, what is corporate prayer properly done? Well, it can edify, it can galvanize the group, it can focus the group on a certain thought. All of that is good, you know. It just doesn't have to cross the line into something else. And it can be short and it can be sweet. And so this is where Jesus is trying to get us. He's telling us what prayer is not, right? But what is prayer? And that's what we need to take a look at. And we've looked at these different ideas about prayer. But Paul tells us something really interesting that has to give us a little bit of pause here to start redefining what prayer means to us. He tells us to pray continuously. So if we're going to pray continuously, does that mean this continuous stream of words? If it does, then we're all going to appear like we need to be 5150 because we're going to be talking to ourselves all the time, you know? And if we're keeping that interior dialogue going on, then people are going to see that glazed look in our eyes all the time. You know, we're not really going to be present to them. This is not what Paul is talking about. It's not what Jesus is talking about. I came across do y'all know what TED is on the internet? TED is that site that has all the talks and lectures and things by really interesting people. It's a great site. Anyway, I came across one by Matt Killingsworth, and I really fell in love with this one. Matt Killingsworth is a researcher, kind of a sociologist, researcher type, and a real egghead anyway. He developed a phone app for the iPhone, and somehow he got 15,000 people to put this app on their phone, and all said when he did the whole study, he had 650,000 bits of data to work with. What he was trying to find out was what makes people happy, you know. And if you want to go to the TED thing, it's Matt Killingsworth, something about happiness, I forget. But this phone app did one thing. It rang you randomly during the day. And when you got your phone call, you would look at this thing and it would ask you three questions. First question, what are you doing? Second question, what are you thinking about? Third question, how happy are you? And you had a slider from 1 to 10 where you could drag the slider. What he found out was fascinating. First of all, he calls it mind wandering. We mind wander more than you would ever imagine that we do. In other words, your mind is not thinking about the thing that you are actually doing. Your head is not where your feet are. He found at least half the time that people's minds are not on what they're doing. And he had a scale from different types of activities that were all included in this app. And from a high of when you are personally grooming, brushing your teeth, combing your hair, 97% of the time you're thinking about something else. Think about that. Okay, pretty obvious. Down to 10% of the time your mind is thinking about something else when you're making love. That's pretty bad. And everything else in between, all right? Think about you. How often does your mind wander off of what you're doing? How often do you catch yourself not having heard the last few sentences of what someone has said? Maybe a lot of what someone else hasn't said, you know, or what you read, or you're passing exits on the freeway. Who knows? But you catch yourself. Your mind has wandered off of what you're doing. And if you think about what it is you're thinking about when your mind is wandering, generally it's pretty negative. When we get lost in our heads, we're thinking about unpleasant things. We're thinking about our worries and our regrets and the things that we need to do and the pressures that we face. That's what keeps getting rehearsed over and over in our heads. But what he found out is that even if you're doing something you don't really like that much and you're thinking about something that's really pleasant, you're still just a little bit less happy than if you were thinking about what you're actually doing. Just a little bit. And if you're thinking about something really unpleasant, it goes way down. So he said it's kind of like playing a slot machine where you can lose $1, $10, or $100. Why would you ever play? You are always happiest when you are thinking about what you're actually doing. We just went through 6 months of Brother Lawrence. The genius of Brother Lawrence was called practicing the presence of God. He called it practicing the presence of God. He was the cook in his monastery. All he did was make sure that he was aware of God's presence in everything he was doing. It took him years to get to the point where he felt he didn't need to have any personal devotions anymore or set prayer time except that which he was obligated to do, because he was just always imbued and aware of God's presence, practicing presence. He said, I banish all thoughts except the one that is essential for the present duty. You know what? If we just did that, went through our lives thinking about what it is we are actually doing at the moment, it would transform us. Life would change completely if we could just do that. And all the meditation techniques that you can think of that you might have tried, some of you might do yoga, some of you do centering prayer, some of you devotionals, whatever. Every one of those is geared toward the same thing. To banish all thoughts, to just let them subside, except the one that's essential for the present duty. And if you're just sitting there in meditation, then you don't have to think about anything. You can just be. The ancient desert fathers and mothers called it quies, which is a Latin word for rest. Their prayer was a prayer of rest. Yes, they sang the Psalms, and yes, they did their things in corporate, but alone, it was a short prayer, Kyrie eleison, and then a moving into rest. Just the wordless awareness of God's presence, that we can do continuously. That we can take into every single facet, every corner of our lives, into every conversation, even the most distasteful work that we have to do sometimes, into the most adversarial and anxious moments and circumstances. We can bring that sense of rest to that if we have practiced it under ideal circumstances, in our quiet time, in time that we set aside. Clearing the space, Jesus says. He wasn't immune from this. He went out to the wilderness and up to the hill to get away from his friends, to get away from everything, to find quies, so that he could bring that back to the group and give them what he had found, give them the renewed connection with his Father that we tend to lose, that tends to dissipate as we stay in the noisy parts of our lives. But you can bring your quiet with you. This is what prayer is. It's this way of living life with these things in the front of our minds, in awareness. We have to have the purpose if we're really going to get where we're trying to go. And we have to tweak and understand that prayer is something other than what we thought it was. You know, it's practice for all these other moments in our lives, all these other places. It's the happiest we will ever be. When you have a moment where your mind is completely on what you are doing, think about it. That's where you feel alive. That's where you feel connected. Once again, it's why we love extreme sports. If you're hanging by your fingernails 1,000 feet above the desert floor on a rock face, you're not worrying about whether you left the porch light on. It's not going to happen. You know? Loud music, thrill rides, falling in love. All these things we love because they are so intense, they automatically take all our thoughts away except the one that's right here. But we can learn to do that on ourselves, and every moment can have the capacity to be that kingdom moment, to be that great time. But what is it? Why do you feel good when you have that moment? Why do you feel good when your thoughts are only about what you're doing? Why is it of value? Is there a reason for that? And I wanted to read you those two paragraphs that we read on Wednesday night that kind of we had to stop and talk about for half an hour or so. Because Thomas is giving us the answer here. He's telling us why these moments of pure presence mean so much to us and feel the way that they do. And he's talking about the desert fathers and mothers in all of their writings and all the stories about them. He writes, "There is a repeated insistence on the primacy of love over everything else in the spiritual life. A repeated insistence on the primacy of love over everything else in the spiritual life. Over knowledge, over asceticism, over contemplation, solitude, and prayer. Love, in fact, is the spiritual life. Love, in fact, is the spiritual life. And without it, all the other exercises of the spirit, however lofty, are emptied of content and become mere illusions." You're hearing Paul in there? "If I have not love, I'm a clanging cymbal." Mere illusions. And the more lofty they are, the more dangerous the illusion. How about that? The more we think we're really getting there, the more dangerous it is to us, spiritually speaking. Love, of course, means something much more than mere sentiment, much more than token favors and perfunctory alms deeds. In other words, most of us would first define love as a feeling, or that it needs to have that feeling of affection, that feeling of sentimentality. Thomas is saying, no, it's not that, you know, or it's beyond that. It's not. It's much more than just that sentiment, token favors and alms deeds, giving. Love means an interior and spiritual identification with one's brother and sister. An interior and spiritual identification with one's brother so that he is not regarded as an object to which one does good. That the fact is that good done to another as an object is of little or no spiritual value. Do you see what he's saying here? As soon as it's about obedience, as soon as it's about following rules to an ethical code, a moral code, or to the law, as soon as we have reduced the other to an object to which we do good, a good deed that gets us something over here, a quid pro quo of some kind. As soon as we have looked at this relationship from a legal perspective, it has ceased to do us any spiritual good. We have left the realm of being able to learn anything from this relationship. Love takes one's neighbor as one's other self and loves him with all the immense humility and discretion and reserve and reverence without which no one can presume to enter into the sanctuary of another's subjectivity. A lot of words there. What's he saying? Love is identification with the beloved. It's not a feeling. It's not a behavior. It's not a deed. It's simply identification. Seeing the other as yourself. An extension of yourself. Losing where you end and the other begins so that everything you do is as if you did it to yourself. Matching your desire to God's desire, which is that kind of unity, that is that kind of seeing everyone as yourself, in the same boat together, rowing. No degree, no differentiation, no hierarchy, just together, pulling, trying to float each other's boats higher. It's hard to really love others if love is to be taken in the full sense of the word. Love demands a complete inner transformation. For without this, we cannot possibly come to identify ourselves with our brother. Without that complete inner transformation, we can't possibly identify ourselves with our brother. What's he talking about? He's talking about the born-again experience. That's what it is. It's stopping to see life with our eyes, with our fears, with our needs, our ability to separate ourselves from each other and turning it around and looking at it from God's perspective, through God's eyes, which only sees the unity and connection, inner transformation, absolutely essential to being able to even do this. For without this, we cannot possibly come to identify ourselves with our brother. We have to become, in some sense, the person we love. We have to become the person we love. And this involves a kind of death of our own being, of our own self. Becoming born again. Taking everything that we thought we knew and had and letting it go so that we can come into something brand new. Thomas Merton says love is the spiritual life. It is the spiritual journey. He said love is identification, becoming one with the beloved. Therefore, if he's right, then the spiritual life and the spiritual journey is becoming identified and one with our brother and our sister and our God. That's what it is. That's it. It's so simple, right? So easy. Can't we do that? What did Jesus just tell us at the end of the chapter before? He told us, yeah, it's easy if you want to love your neighbor, if you want to love the person who loves you. How about trying to love the enemy? How about if that enemy tells you to go 1 mile with him and has the authority to do so, you don't just do the 1 mile, you actually take and go a second mile? It's the same thing that Jesus is trying to get across to us. The first mile teaches us nothing spiritually. The first mile is just following rules. It's what we're obligated to do. It's what we have to do without going to prison or getting shot on the spot. The Romans had that authority. You had to go the first mile. What happens, what changes if you now go the second mile? Voluntarily. You voluntarily go a second mile. What has changed in your relationship with the enemy, with the oppressor? You see, how can we love someone that we don't like? How can we love someone that we actually are disgusted by? that we have no feelings whatsoever, who is actually our adversary at the moment. How can we love that person, not feel something for him or her, but do what love requires? The only way that that can take place is when we start to see them as ourselves. We break through that barrier that sees them as wholly other, as subhuman, as something that we can hate, that we can set aside, that we can love less, because now we start to see them as ourselves. The second mile teaches us everything about that. The spiritual journey is becoming identified and one with everyone that we meet when we meet them. Loving the enemy, going the second mile, only possible when we become identified. It is the Lord's Prayer. It is the spiritual journey. It is the sum total of everything that we're here to do. Matching our purpose to God's purpose is this same unity, this same connection. That's it. It's the whole thing. It sounds too simple, right? You probably have a million questions in your head right now. Well, what about the cross? What about salvation? What about this? What about that? You know? What about confession if you grew up Catholic? It can't be that simple. There are mechanics to salvation that God put in place. But we will never be able to take advantage of them or know that they're there or have it in any way transform our lives until we can break this barrier that separates us one from another. We won't know we're saved. We won't understand how God loves us. It's not possible. Jesus said, "If you follow my commandments, then you're truly my disciple, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." The truth will set you free. You want to know what that truth is that sets us free? $64,000 question. It's kind of like asking for the meaning of life and everything to the computer. Okay, never mind. The truth that sets us free is that everyone is worthy of connection, including us. Everyone is worthy of connection. What we find out when we start loving the enemy is that as soon as that happens, we are seeing this person that we formerly hated as worthy of connection. And we find ourselves able to provide it, to supply it. And at that moment, we are free. Free of resentment. Free of obsessive compulsive drives and needs and all of the stuff that tears apart our lives from the inside out. As soon as we love the enemy, as soon as we go the second mile, we realize that person is also worthy of connection. And you start to experience the nature of the Father's love, who is saying you are worthy of connection. The reason we're not supposed to judge others is because we judge ourselves first. If they are not worthy of connection, then how can we know for sure that we are worthy of connection? We can't. It keeps us running. It keeps us living in fear. We can't know the truth that makes us free until we follow Jesus' commands. He said it right there in that line. And what are Jesus' commands? To treat everyone as if they're worthy of connection. If we can do that, even before we feel it or know it or understand it, fake it until you make it, something begins to change in us and we realize they are and we can and we are and God does. Until we experience this, it will never set us free. It's not mental. It's not words. It's what we live day in and day out. We have to experience the truth to know that it's free. Prayer, properly understood, whether it's the Lord's Prayer or any prayer that we say and make a part of our lives, has to include this time to step away from our words, from our thoughts, from our minds, and into the presence and identity that is our Father. And it prepares us to identify with everyone that we meet. This is too big to grasp all at once. I don't know whether you agree with me right now or not. I don't know if you have a million questions or not. It doesn't even really matter. We can understand the words, we can understand the concepts, we can even agree with them, but they won't change anything until we've walked down the road a ways, spent moments in this experience. It's just the way it works. And it'll be amazing what you can agree to, and then you walk away, and suddenly it's gone again. It's like using a word three times, you know, the definition. You got to use a word three times before you really have the definition. It's kind of like that. You have to reuse it. And then finally it becomes yours, and you realize you are transformed and you're free of certain things. It's too big to grasp it all. Right now we maybe understand the words, but the immensity of God's love, the immensity of God's salvation can only be seen bit by bit, a little bit at a time. And every time we love someone who doesn't deserve it, who we think doesn't deserve it, something breaks down in us. Another brick comes out of the wall that separates us from our God and from everything that we want out of life. Let's pray. In words, corporately, I'll see what I can do to avoid my own conflict of interest. Father, we praise you. We acknowledge who you are and who we are not. We acknowledge who you made us to be. We acknowledge that we are your children, we're your dependents, and it's a beautiful place to be. We acknowledge that it's okay not to be in charge, to let you be in charge, that we can just play in the house that you provide for us, to sit at your feet and know that everything is going to be okay because you're here and you're going to provide for us this day, this day. Father, that makes us grateful. It makes us secure. It makes us feel good. And we just ask that you would help us more and more to take bricks out of our walls that separate us, to have the courage to keep doing that, to extend to someone else all the gifts that we're starting to understand you have extended to us so that we can complete the circuit and know that we know that we know that your truth is that we are worthy of you and your love and your connection. That's all we want, Lord. Thank you for loving us the way that you do. And once again, we acknowledge that we can only love in this way because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.